husband took over as Sabrina's showrunner, and I appreciated that Viacom hadn't replaced me with a male writer. Eventually, that happened. Miriam called me to check in and offered some helpful advice. "Here's my recommendation," Miriam said. "Never watch the show again." I took her advice, although once, while switching channels on a plane, I caught a scene from a much later season. Sabrina and her aunts were arguing in the Spellman kitchen, and the characters' attitudes were unrecognizable to me. The only things that felt familiar were the little teacup handles on the kitchen cabinets that I had picked out with the set decorator for the pilot. Sabrina continued for 3 more years on ABC and 2 on the WB. Ratings were never as high as that first season, but they remained strong enough for the show to sell into syndication. In 2016, the show celebrated its 20th anniversary, and a reporter reached out to women who'd grown up watching. Lena Dunham was 10 when the show premiered and shared this. "Sabrina the Teenage Witch was truly formative for me on every level. It was subtly radical feminist storytelling, never denying the power of sisterhood or the magic of a teenage girl. Sabrina had agency, she had spunk, and it took the form of magic. It makes me laugh to this day. I feel lucky it was on TV for girls like me." Lena's words made me think back to the table read where I fought to keep the aunts welcoming of their niece. Never denying the power of sisterhood turned out to be a key to our success. As a science fiction fan, there are times I fantasize about visiting a parallel universe where I'd stayed on as Sabrina's showrunner. I'd like to meet Alt Nell and ask if it was worth navigating the obstacles to create bigger flans and lintier monsters, but mostly I want to go to that parallel universe and spend time with Alt Barry Marks, who is still alive and well and flashing his sweet, kind-hearted smile. Stage 3. Get me a younger, cheaper Nell Scovell. Chapter 11. Poetry is in the doing. Welcome the Felicitous Accident. Arthur Penn on Directing Movies. In December 2002, Colin and I attended the L.A. Film Critics Association gala dinner at the elegant Hotel Casa Del Mar. We were penthousing, or whatever the opposite of slumming is. From our primo table, I was close enough to rub Daniel Day-Lewis's shaved head. I could hear Julianne Moore snapping her gum. I could feel the glare of Jack Nicholson's grin as he presided over the About Schmidt table. And directly across from me sat our friend, Arthur Penn, who was receiving a Lifetime Achievement Award for a body of work that included Bonnie and Clyde, Little Big Man, and Penn and Teller Get Killed. That last one wasn't Arthur's best-known film, but it's the reason we met. I'd interviewed Arthur for Rolling Stone in 1986 and kept our interview going for the next 25 years. The other seats at our table filled up with Arthur's friends and my heroes, Tootsie writer and MASH creator Larry Gelbart, Mel Brooks and his wife Anne Bancroft. Arthur directed Anne in The Miracle Worker on Broadway, and they both won Tony Awards. He also directed her in the film version, and both were nominated for Academy Awards. Anne took home the Oscar that year, but Arthur lost to David Lean and Lawrence of Arabia. Talk about a category killer. The Film Critics Gala was a true celebration of cinema. As one winner noted, "It's lovely to receive an award from people who actually saw the movies." Spanish director Pedro Almodovar kept coming over to our table to hug Arthur. Later, Almodovar observed in his charming, accented English, "You are the nicest people I ever have dinner with. For an orgy, I don't know. I have to look around. But for dinner, very nice." Toward the end of the program, Anne Bancroft rose from her seat and headed to the stage to present Arthur with his award. As soon as she arrived at the podium, a voice rang out from our table. "Mention me!" Mel Brooks shouted. "I'm not gonna," Anne shouted back in her native Brooklyn accent. The entire room cracked up. Anne lavished praise on Arthur to the point that he started turning red, then he joined her on the stage. Arthur spoke about his life in the theater and movies, and the importance of his friends, his wife, and his children, Matt and Molly. There were two standing ovations that night. One was for Arthur Penn, and the other was for Arthur Penn. The gala was a once-in-a-lifetime evening, but I was just as happy sitting alone with Arthur in his Central Park West apartment listening to him tell stories. Arthur knew an astonishing number of artists, literally starting from birth since his older brother was celebrated photographer Irving Penn. At Black Mountain College, Arthur studied with Buckminster Fuller. Before Mike Nichols became a renowned director, he asked Arthur to direct An Evening with Mike Nichols and Elaine May. Arthur even knew Dorothy Parker. "It was horrible how drinking destroyed her," he once told me, shaking his head. Arthur and I spent a lot of time talking about directing. It's what he loved, and he'd revolutionized the form. Now it's a trope to shoot violence realistically and in slow motion, but Arthur pioneered that style with The Ambush that ends Bonnie and Clyde. When I got my first directing assignment in 1998, one of my first emails went to Arthur with the subject line, "Help." I realized that asking Arthur to mentor someone making a Showtime family movie was a little like asking Michael Phelps to teach your 5-year-old how to swim. But if Phelps is willing, why not? Oddly, what inspired me to become a director was not greatness, but mediocrity. In the years that I'd been writing and producing sitcoms, I'd worked with 100 directors. Many were thoughtful and skilled, but a few bumbled their way through, barely knowing the script or planning the blocking. I drew my inspiration from their incompetence. As a director, I wasn't gunning for visionary genius like Arthur, but I figured I could clear the bar of solidly mediocre. After Sabrina, Viacom Productions wanted to find a new project for us to work on together. They asked if I had a movie premise that could later be turned into a TV series. Watching the young actors on Sabrina had sparked an idea. What if a washed-up, has-been 16-year-old former child star had to go to high school for the first time? For her, it would be weird to be normal. Viacom liked the idea and made a deal for me to write the script. My one request? I wanted to direct. We pitched Haley Wagner, star, to Showtime executive Dominique Telson. She bought it and approved me as a first-time director. I don't believe it's a coincidence that I owe my big break to an African-American female executive. My timing was good to expand into a traditionally male field. During the 1990s, women were securing more leadership positions. Ruth Bader Ginsburg joined Sandra Day O'Connor on the Supreme Court. Ann Richards became governor of Texas. Madeleine Albright was named Secretary of State. Like Sally Ride, the women's movement was racing towards equality at mock speeds. Until 1998, when President Bill Clinton's dick brought it all to a screeching halt. For more on this, please read my book, Just the Swollen Parts. The technical aspects of directing scared me the most. Stu Bass, the editor on Sabrina, and I spent countless hours discussing blocking and camera placement. To me, preparation was the key, but Arthur cautioned me not to lock into all my shots before stepping on set. "Welcome the felicitous accident," he said. Arthur urged me to resist the urge to shout "cut" when a fly bothers an actor or an actress struggles to walk in high heels. An itchy nose, an unstable gait, can all lend a moment of tension or verisimilitude. Arthur also recommended that I get options. Once I had the take that I was looking for, he encouraged me to get the take that I hadn't been looking for. "Wait for the moment," Arthur advised me. "What moment?" "The one you're waiting for," he said with a smile. The film would shoot in Vancouver, where the American dollar stretched further. I hated the thought of being away from home for 6 weeks. One consolation was that since leaving Sabrina, I hadn't been working crazy long hours. I'd taken a development deal with Brillstein Gray and consulted on a few shows. Currently, I was working 3 days a week on the medical show Providence. As always, it helped knowing that Colin was capable of taking care of 3-year-old Rudy and not yet 1-year-old Dexter. Vancouver was gorgeous, and I quickly fell in love with its waterfront parks and cheap sushi. I lucked out that Viacom hired Richard Davis, a delightful white-bearded Australian, to produce the movie. Richard had decades of experience and was supportive without being coddling. He felt like a partner from the start. Still, I worried about being accepted by the rest of the crew. There are 3 things the Canadian crews dislike, a friend in L.A. had warned. He ticked them off on his fingers. 1, American directors. 2, first-time directors. 3, female directors. Triple threat, baby. From the moment I stepped on set, I felt some pushback. The director of photography, DP, who's in charge of the camera department, would sometimes roll his eyes at my choices for framing a shot. In one scene, Haley was auditioning for a part in a school play. The DP thought the shot should be tight, focusing on actress Bethany Richards' face. I asked for a looser shot, starting at Bethany's waist, to catch her funny body language and fabulous outfit styled by Elizabeth Stewart. The DP kept pushing for tighter. When I finally insisted on the looser shot, he literally threw up his hands. "That's what she wants, so give it to her," he informed the cameraman, then walked to the other side of the set. Stephen Gagan, screenwriter of Traffic and director of Syriana, once sat next to me at a guild meeting and boiled down the experience of being a director. "You think you'll get to be the dictator on the set?" Stephen said, "but really you're the center that always has to give, the space that finds harmony." I struggled to find harmony that day, and I beat myself up that night. I knew it was a mistake to piss off the DP, who has tremendous influence on the production. Fearing that I'd lost his crucial support, I emailed Arthur and asked for advice. He wrote back, "On my first Hollywood film, the crew drove me nuts with, 'This is the way we do it,' slowly and meticulously and phony. Implied, not like you TV parvenus who have no tradition and just slop it. I asked the DP to shoot with 2 cameras. He resisted. I insisted. He wrote on the clapboard slate for camera 2, shot under protest. The battle lines were drawn." It was comforting to know that even Arthur, an experienced man, had wrestled with the same situation. I stopped beating myself up for insisting on a shot. That was my job. Still, I knew the movie would turn out better if those battle lines were erased. I wanted to get the crew more on my side, but how? Then I welcomed a felicitous accident. Early in our 2nd week, we were shooting near a pond when the skies opened up. Most of the crew headed back to the trucks to stay dry, but I decided to stay close to the set so I could jump back in as soon as the rain stopped. A small tarp had been set up nearby, not to shield humans, but to protect the expensive equipment. I headed over, wrapping my purple Patagonia raincoat tightly around me. As soon as I ducked under the tarp, I realized I wasn't alone. Harvey LaRoque, the A camera operator, had stayed with his camera, watching over it like the captain of a ship. We exchanged nods, as we'd done since the project started, never speaking at any length. But as the rain pounded away, I felt pressure to make conversation. "Where are you from, Harvey?" I asked. "A small town in Ontario," he responded. "Parry Sound." "Bobby Orr's hometown." Harvey reacted, startled. "How'd you know that?" "I'm from Boston. I grew up watching the Bruins." "I don't believe it," he said. It was more an expression of surprise than a challenge, but since we had nothing better to do, I decided to rattle off the names of the Bruin players from that era. Bobby Orr, Phil Esposito, Johnny Busick, Wayne Cashman, Kenny Hodge, Jerry Cheevers, John McKenzie, Derek Sanderson. When I got to Dallas Smith, Harvey held up his hand. "Okay, I believe you," he said. We both smiled. The sun didn't break out at that moment, although in the movie version it will. And from that moment on, Harvey became my secret weapon on the set. When the DP and I hit an impasse, Harvey would try to bridge the gap, sauntering into the set to offer an adjustment that brokered a compromise. Instead of a showdown, the process became collaborative, which is always better. Connecting with Harvey helped, but I still felt like an outsider. Once, I saw a small group of crew members off to the side of the set laughing. I headed over, and as I neared, they clammed up. "Sorry," I said. "I didn't mean to interrupt."
"It was nothing," said a cameraman.
"Well, it looked like you were laughing about something," I said. A crew member pointed at another.
"He was just telling a dirty joke."
"Ooh, I want to hear," I said. "Not in front of a lady," he demurred. So I told the group a joke, so disgusting that I can't even repeat it here. From then on, the crew included me in their huddles. Once at craft services, a gaffer sidled up to me. "Have you heard this one?" he asked. "What's the difference between a refrigerator and a woman?" I had no idea. "A refrigerator doesn't fart when you take the meat out." It was a gross joke, but a sweet moment. The Haley Wagner Star set found harmony thanks to a hardworking crew, strong producer, supportive studio, and focused cast that included Priscilla Presley, Megan Ory, and Pam Grier. Even our dreaded night shoot turned out fine. It helped that I cast Penn Jillette to play the director of the zombie movie within the movie. Seeing an old friend's face made a long night easier. Allison Hannigan flew up during a Buffy the Vampire Slayer hiatus to play the star of the zombie movie. Channeling a self-centered diva was a stretch for Allison, who was anything but. Still, she seemed to have a certain actress in mind while playing the part. I returned to L.A. to edit and happily reunite with my family. Our early rising one-year-old was thrilled to have more alert company in the mornings. I'm more of a morning person than Colin. And no parent enjoyed driving their three-year-old to preschool more than I did that first week back. Haley Wagner Star scored solid ratings when it aired in 1999, and Bethany Richards earned a well-deserved nomination for a Young Artist Award. Viacom cut a trailer, and the WB ordered a TV pilot. Sadly, the network wouldn't approve me as the director. I turned again to Robbie Benson, who'd done such a stellar job on Sabrina. Lightning didn't strike twice, and Haley Wagner, star, didn't make it to series. The success of Hannah Montana 6 years later made me think we were in the right ballpark on the wrong day. The learning curve of directing was steep, and I wanted to keep the momentum going. I met with my agents and shared my intention to find another opportunity right away. "I'll take any meeting," I told the three guys in suits. "I'm open to anything. I just want to direct." The agents exchanged looks. I felt the chill in the room. "You know, Nell," one agent said, "the second movie is the hard one to get." That made no sense. The first was the hard one because I needed to find someone to take a chance. Now I'd made a film, a well-received on-budget film. I had experience. We could build off that. "How can that be?" I challenged. The agent shrugged. "That's just the way it is." I walked away, demoralized. Those agents never got me a single meeting for directing. Not one. Sometimes I blame myself for not being more aggressive and seeking out opportunities on my own. But directing is exhausting, and to have to push to do it felt like being forced to run a marathon before you're allowed to climb Mount Everest. In 2016, I wrote an op-ed for the New York Times about the lack of progress that female directors have made since the 80s. Despite all the programs to develop talent and mentor women and people of color, the percentage of diverse directors wasn't rising. People insist it's a pipeline problem. Instead, I dubbed it a broken doorbell problem. Competent and talented women are right there on the doorstep, leaning on the buzzer, but no one is answering the door. This fault lies in our culture's misperceptions. Studies show that employers routinely perceive men as more competent than women, even when the data doesn't support that claim.
For example, software code written by women is routinely rated as higher quality by male engineers, unless the raters know who wrote it. Once gender is identified, the raters devalue the female-generated work. Men applying for jobs also benefit from being able to openly acknowledge their success. Too often, women are taught to downplay their success with statements like, "I got lucky," or "I had help." Guess what? The men got lucky and had help too. These double standards make it harder for women to be seen as capable of helming a blockbuster. The massive success of Patty Jenkins' Wonder Woman may move the needle, or not. The year after Kathryn Bigelow won an Oscar for Best Director, the percentage of women directing features actually dipped. When employers hesitate to hire a female director, they claim it's rooted in an aversion to risk. I see it as a surrender to bias. My agent's warning about the second movie being harder to get became a self-fulfilling prophecy. It took 8 years for me to get my next assignment. Joey Plager is the kind of dogged producer that every writer dreams about. Long ago, Joey optioned Betrayals, a script I co-wrote with my sister Claire in the 80s. A cross between Sex and the City and Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None, Betrayals revolved around five female college roommates who gather for their 10th reunion. Each roommate reveals a dirty secret that they've never told anyone, like committing adultery, going to rehab, insider trading. After the confessions, they hug and feel closer than ever. But when the five roommates return home, each receives a blackmail note. It's clearly an inside job, but which of the five is the blackmailer? After over a decade of dust gathered on the script, Joey swept it off and pitched the low-budget project to Suzanne Daniels, who was president of entertainment at Lifetime. Suzanne approved me as the director. I don't believe it's a coincidence that a female executive gave me my second break. Still, there was a catch. There's always a catch. The movie needed to go into production immediately, which conflicted with my current job as consulting producer on NCIS. We had 2 episodes left on the season, but my bosses let me bow out early. It cost me more money than I'd make as a director, but I was so excited to be getting another shot. Production would take place in Vancouver, again, and the reality of low-budget movie-making hit hard. The French production company that was co-financing the project sent along their request that I shoot the movie to look like Hitchcock. The shower scene alone in Psycho took 7 days to film. We had 17 days total for the entire movie. I said I would try, but unfortunately, the Betrayals crew would have frustrated Ed Wood. There were normal mishaps and mistakes, like when the locations manager forgot to make sure the sauna we were shooting in had been turned off the night before. That morning, we opened the cedar door and felt a blast of heat. The DP declared, "It's like a sauna in here." The heat fogged the camera lens, so we cut the breaker and brought in fans. It took over an hour to cool down the set. Even then, it remained toasty. At one point, the makeup person had to wipe real sweat off the actresses before spritzing them with fake sweat. We wanted a lovely glow, not a literal hot mess. Before the shoot began, I worried that having 5 female co-stars would generate a lot of drama. That notion was sexist. The actresses were professional and completely supportive of each other. We had no rehearsal time, so they arranged to get together on their own and run lines. When we didn't have stand-ins to help the DP light scenes, the actresses would pull double duty and remain on set so that shots would look better. The 6 of us formed a tight-knit group, in part because we felt under siege. The DP was tight with the Canadian producer who dealt with the money and hired the crew. Together, they repeatedly tried to box me out. They asked for my storyboards, blueprints for how I planned to block and shoot each scene. When I shared them, they immediately started reblocking the cameras, addressing each other while ignoring me. When I called the two on it, they laughed. "We're just so used to working with each other," the producer said. "We've got a shorthand." At a loss, I shot another emergency email to Arthur. He responded, immediately. Nell, close the gap right away. Don't let them get control in your presence. You know certainly they will talk behind your back, that's a given. But in your presence, you take charge. Don't be stunned by these guys. Expect venality. Second point, a storyboard is a license for all to direct. I hate them. It's an open invitation to all the power wielders to beat you to the punch. If you must have it, keep it minimal, bare bones. Third, close down the field of discussion. Keep it specific. Your concern is the sufficiency of exterior shots? Okay, let's review those. Walk me through the movie. Reframe that. Don't let it be about shots. Talk tone, mood, atmosphere, the ineffable that distinguishes you, the director. Sorry if this sounds paternalistic, not my intention. The director's role is mysterious, personal, and must not be reduced only to hardware and its function. There's a quotient of poetry that is not describable. It's in the doing. Love you, Nell. This note still makes me tear up. I'm sharing Arthur's words so that others can see how the best mentors go beyond offering practical advice. They also break down the psychology of the dynamic, which is usually only understood after years of painful experience. Finally, the best mentors inspire. There's a quotient of poetry that is not describable. It's in the doing. Nothing could have made me want to fight for my vision more than Arthur's definition of the director's role. In my first movie, the crew warmed to me by the end. In my second, relations grew colder. The third to last day, we had a killer schedule with 10 pages to shoot. I came in with all my blocking and approached the DP to discuss. He refused to talk to me. I pressed him to tell me what was wrong. "The actresses broke my heart," he said. "I no longer care about this movie." And they say women are emotional? I had no idea what the DP meant by his statement, but I couldn't question him further because he walked off the set. We were on the clock, so I went over my shot list with a cameraman who was inexperienced but present. The actresses came in fully prepared and ready to work. Miraculously, we made it through 6 pages before lunch. I returned from our break to block a shorter scene in the same set. Suddenly, the DP reappeared in an upbeat, chatty mood. "I have an idea for how you should shoot this next scene," he said, then launched into his suggestion. His method seemed complicated. "Let's stick with what I've got," I said. "It worked this morning." "This'll be faster," he said. I was skeptical. The DP called the producer over and pitched him the plan. "It would take 3 hours, tops," the DP said. The producer turned and looked me straight in the eye. "That's the way you should shoot that scene," he said. I ignored Arthur's advice and let them take control. It was a disaster. 4.5 hours later, the 2.5-page scene still wasn't complete. We were grabbing close-ups when the producer returned to set. "You're done. This scene's over," he announced. "Moving on." "But we don't have all the pieces," I said. "Too bad," he said, then added, "You did this to yourself." I bit my tongue a lot on that shoot, but not this time. "You know I didn't design these shots. And you know you're the one who approved them," I said. "Don't play the blame game," he screamed. That was the day I ended up sobbing on the floor of a coat closet on the phone with my friend Jesse Dillon. I was so lucky he was available. Jesse's advice to go down fighting snapped me out of my tailspin. I returned to set, and in the last 3 hours, I got what I needed. Sort of. Back in L.A., Stu Bass took the footage and performed his editing magic, teasing out both the comedy and the suspense. The actresses turned in superb performances under trying conditions, and the friendships they formed shone through on screen. Lifetime changed the title, and the film premiered on November 11th, 2007, the same week that I turned 47. The previous week, Hollywood was shut down by a Writers Guild strike, which lasted through February. Once again, I hoped to build momentum, but as it turns out, The third movie is the hard one to get. Since then, I've only had the opportunity to shoot one half-hour episode of the MTV show Awkward. It's hard to know if I could have become a decent director. A person supposedly needs 10,000 hours of deliberate practice to master proficiency in a skill. I'm currently about 9,500 hours short. In 2009, I visited Arthur and his wife Peggy at their home in New York City. In his 80s, Arthur had recently suffered a medical setback. We went for a short walk over to Central Park, then returned to the apartment. Over tea, I mentioned that I'd just seen an article about the 50th anniversary of the Broadway debut of The Miracle Worker. "I rewatched the movie recently," I said, "and it's a very different experience as a parent. I cried so much harder at the beginning." Arthur nodded. He had grown quiet. Maybe he was knocked out by our walk, so I continued talking. "When was the last time you watched The Miracle Worker?" "You know, I've never seen either of the movies that I directed since they aired. It's too painful when you know the difficulties behind every scene. But then I've only made low-budget cable movies. You've made beautiful movies, nominated for Oscars. You must be able to watch and enjoy them, right?" Arthur shook his head. "You always remember the compromises," he said. "It's a bargain with the devil." Chapter 12. The Ones That Got Away. Anosmia. 1. The loss of the sense of smell, either total or partial. 2. A great name for an X-Files episode. Do you enjoy disappointment? You do? Then I have the perfect industry for you. Hollywood disappointment comes in all shapes and sizes. There's the bittersweet early disappointment that can still make you smile at your own naivete. There's the late-in-your-career disappointment, where you're surprised to learn that you still care enough to feel let down. There's even the inexplicable disappointment where you feel bad about not getting offered a job that you didn't want. I've had a wide variety of disappointments, but if I had to choose, these are the top 5 projects that I wish had turned out differently. The X-Files. In the spring of 1995, I signed an overall deal with 20th Century Fox that included an assistant and a corner office. On my first day, the operations manager walked me over to a warehouse filled with furniture. Since my title was executive producer, he ushered me over to the good stuff and told me to pick out whatever pieces I wanted. Using post-it notes, I tagged a desk and a lamp, then searched for a sofa. Most were black or brown leather and looked like they'd light up one of those CSI DNA semen detection tests. Then a couch covered in a pink and green floral chintz pattern caught my eye. It was positively girly. "Is that one available?" I asked, pointing to the flowery couch. "Yeah," the operations guy said. "It belonged to Lucy Selhaney." "Seriously?" I said. "That will make my power naps feel more powerful." Lucy Selhaney may not be a household name, but her influence on our culture is enormous. In the 80s, Lucy helped launch 4 syndicated shows that hit almost every demographic. Entertainment Tonight, The Arsenio Hall Show, Star Trek The Next Generation, and Hard Copy. In the 90s, Rupert Murdoch brought her in to be chairman of Fox, making her the first woman to run a major broadcast network. She had an extraordinary first year, overseeing the network's expansion from 4 nights of programming to 7 and leading the negotiations to secure NFL game rights. The third year, Murdoch reportedly breached a guarantee in Lucy's contract. She lawyered up and resigned. "The reason I left was very complicated," she told me on the phone in 2017. "Rupert and I never really got along. He didn't like the fact that I didn't check in with him all the time or go to his house on Saturday, and he lied to me. He was a bully, distrustful, and discriminated against me, as he did with most women." Lucy is fearless and funny. We only recently connected when I called to confirm that we had shared the same chintzy couch. "Yes," she said, "that was mine." I told her my theory about the other leather couches being covered in genetic material.
There was no semen on my couch, she assured me. Just a lot of blueberry, yogurt, and pineapple smoothies.
I thanked her for that and for something else. While chairman at Fox, Lucy greenlit The X-Files, one of my all-time favorite TV shows. From my Fox office window, I could see creator Chris Carter's bungalow. Even better, I knew one of the writers, Howard Gordon, who went on to help shape the cult TV trifecta of The X-Files, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and 24. Occasionally, I'd stop by Howard's office to chat. One day, I worked up the courage to ask him if I could pitch some story ideas. They only had one freelance script left, but Howard said he'd check with Chris. To my amazement, Chris said he'd be happy to hear my pitches. I knew moving to the next stage was a long shot. As a female writer, the odds of writing an episode for The X-Files were slightly worse than surviving The Hunger Games. This is not an exaggeration. During the show's original run, only 7 of 200 episodes, 3.5%, were written by women. Meanwhile, 1 out of 24 survived The Hunger Games, 4.2%. Katniss had it easy. The morning of my pitch, I got out of bed and almost threw up. That was partially because I was nervous about meeting Chris, but also because I was 12 weeks pregnant. My condition made me self-conscious. The X-Files was, and still is, a boys' club and boys don't get pregnant. To cover up my puffy abdomen, I dressed in an oversized button-down shirt and tied a sweater around my hips. When I entered the bungalow, Chris greeted me warmly and I sat down quickly. I pitched 3 stories, and both Howard and Chris sparked to one called Anosmia. The story kicks off with a kooky cat lady who contacts the FBI after her cats go missing from her Florida apartment complex. Agent Mulder investigates and finds that tensions are running high between the mixed-race tenants. Mulder gets a whiff of what's wrong. The government is releasing an alien scent through the apartment ventilation system. The scent drove the animals away. The humans weren't as smart. Soon, tenants start dying off under strange circumstances, as one does in Florida. I told Chris and Howard that smell was the first sense to develop, and it was so successful that, in time, the small lump of olfactory tissue on top of the nerve cord evolved into a brain. Our cerebral hemispheres were originally buds from the olfactory stalks. We think because we smell, I said. Chris suggested that in addition to the alien scent affecting behavior, there should be something in the environment that triggers a hate response. One of us suggested that watching TV news could be that trigger. Fox News was only 2 years old and fairly mild, so we had the idea first. The meeting wrapped up. Chris said they'd discuss my ideas and get back to me. Howard called the next day with good news. Chris dug Anosmia, and because my pitch was so detailed, I was approved to go to Outline. I'd snagged the last freelance X-Files episode of the 5th season. I did a happy dance around Lucy Salhaney's couch. I'd never written an outline for a drama, but I'd seen every X-Files episode and knew the show's rhythm. My teaser opened on a 12-year-old African-American boy swimming in a courtyard pool. His mom runs upstairs to get a towel, figuring the boy will be safe because he's surrounded by neighbors. Bad plan in Florida. A watch falls from a balcony into the water. The boy dives down to retrieve it, and the watch mysteriously pulls him down. When the mom returns, her son is floating in the pool, face up, drowned. Scully immediately knows something is wrong since a drowned body would be facing down. During the autopsy, she lifts the boy's eyelids and discovers that the whites of his pupils have turned yellow. The boy's system appears to have been flooded with bile. Scully explains that long ago, scientists believed that bile was the seat of bitterness. "So what killed the boy?" asks Mulder. "Medieval doctors would have determined that his cause of death was hate," says Scully. With each act, the body count rose. The not-so-subtle message of the episode was that humans had not yet evolved to the point where we could coexist with alien species. In fact, we could barely coexist with each other. This was the final paragraph of the outline. Mulder runs back downstairs to help Scully. As they try to revive Kathleen, Mulder finishes his voiceover. There are many kinds of evil on Earth, so it's easy to forget that evil is not only the thing that destroys, but also the thing that allows evil to destroy. It's easy to recognize evil when it's obvious and cruel, but ignorance and apathy can kill as swiftly and as sure. As the camera floats back to Mrs. Bryant watching TV, we fade out. End of Act 4. It took me a week to finish the outline. As a freelancer, it's hard to know all the rules of a show, so I figured I'd get a lot of notes. A few days later, Chris's assistant called my office and asked me to hold for her boss. My heart started racing. I really wanted Chris to love the outline. He picked up and sounded cheerful. Good sign. "I have an update," Chris said. "The show has some exciting news that hasn't been made public yet." "Really? What's that?" I asked. "It turns out Stephen King is a big fan and he just reached out to us. He wants to write an episode." "That's amazing," I said. "Yeah, the problem is we only have the one freelance assignment left." "Oh." Chris wasn't calling to give me notes. He was calling to let me know that I was getting replaced by Stephen King. I went from 60 to zero in 5 seconds. "We'll definitely pay you for the outline," Chris said, "and maybe next season we can talk again." I hung up the phone. My office had gotten eerily quiet, like abandoned hotel quiet. I'd been so excited, and now I didn't know what to feel. No writer could be angry about getting bumped by the master of horror. It's like learning that Picasso wants to paint over your mural. Have at it, Pablo. King and Chris ended up co-writing Chinga, which featured an antique doll who makes people tear out their eyes. I couldn't bear to watch, so I know how the victims felt. Since then, I've thought about how so many of King's novels revolve around everyday folks whose lives are upended by an agent of chaos, like the rabid dog in Cujo or the clown in It. These Stephen King monsters come out of nowhere and wreak havoc on unsuspecting rubes. And it occurred to me that the Stephen King monster in my life was Stephen King. Robert Altman. In 1976, my father took me to see Robert Altman's Nashville, and it blew my teenage mind. Altman wove together storylines for over a dozen oddball characters and brought them all together for a shocking climax. Driving home afterwards, my dad and I talked about the themes of politics, motherhood, fame, and violence in the film. It was my first grown-up movie discussion, and Altman became my favorite director. In the late 80s, I watched every episode of his HBO miniseries, Tanner 88, which was set on the presidential campaign trail and blurred the lines between fiction and reality. Tanner 88 was a success, and a year later, Altman started pulling together a similar project that would be set in the world of entertainment and star Carol Burnett. When my agent told me that Altman was interested in meeting with me to discuss the project, I thought, "Seriously? Why me?" But I said, "I would love that." "The premise is simple," Altman explained as we sat in his New York City hotel suite. "Carol is touring the South for real, and her concerts provide the backdrop for backstage drama, all fictional. We surround her with a cast of characters, assistant, hairstylist, family members, agent. We'll develop storylines, and because of Carol's skills, we want the actors to improv a lot. But we're also looking for a writer to sit on set and throw out lines. Does that interest you?" I nodded vigorously. "And you're familiar with Carol Burnett?" I worshipped Carol Burnett. As a kid, I watched her variety series religiously and bowed down to her performance as Winifred the Woebegone in Once Upon a Mattress. Winifred belting out "Shy" was my kind of princess. Altman and I brainstormed ideas for ancillary characters. A driver selling secrets to the tabloids, a hairdresser hiding that he's straight, an all-about-Eve type assistant who has no talent. We laughed a lot, and he offered me the job on the spot. "We're moving quickly," he said. "Could you pack this weekend and meet me and Carol in Atlanta next week?" If a family member were on life support, I'd pull the plug so I'd have nothing to keep me from leaving town, I said. "Great," he said. "We'll be in touch soon." I floated home to 57th Street. It was a Friday afternoon, and my agent promised to get into the deal with the network first thing Monday morning. She cautioned me that the pay would be low. Really low. That answered the question, why me? Over the weekend, I called my dad with the news. "Wow," he said, "you're in the big leagues." Monday came, and I hung out at home, waiting for the call while cleaning my apartment in case I needed to bolt. Early afternoon, the phone rang. I heard a brusque male voice. "Nell, it's Bob." I was confused, but "Bob who?" I said. "Bob Altman." "Oh, right, Bob is a nickname for Robert." "The deal's off. CBS is screwing around, so it's not going to happen." "Okay, I gotta go." And with a click, that dream job would forever remain a dream. Pre-Daily Show, Jon Stewart. Jon Stewart has so many Emmy Awards that he could leave one at every exit on the New Jersey Turnpike and still have a couple left over. But before he landed at The Daily Show, created by Liz Winstead and Madeline Smithberg in 1999, Jon sought out potential partners to develop his own show that would shoot in New York City. "I'd just come back from directing my first movie when my agent asked if I wanted to meet him. I called Becky Hartman, a mutual friend and comedy writer, to ask what she thought." "Yes," she declared, "you will love Jon." Jon and I got together in L.A., and we talked about ways to shake up the talk show genre. We were dissecting the format when I pinpointed what I perceived as a dead spot on every late-night talk show. After the host finishes his monologue, he heads back to his desk, which forces him to turn his back on the audience. To cover this staging faux pas, the host typically throws focus to the band leader. Letterman always introduced our good friend Paul Schaefer. The camera would then cut away to Paul, wearing a new pair of zany glasses, while Dave scurried to the desk. It felt like filler, because it was filler. Jon nodded. "So what would you do instead?" "Well, what if," I said, "what if you wore a pair of so fine jeans?" "So fine jeans?" he said. "You know, like from the Ryan O'Neill movie." So Fine was an early 80s Andrew Bergman film about a businessman who needs money and launches a new fashion craze. Buttless pants. "Are you serious?" Jon asked. I wasn't really, but on the drive over to the meeting, I realized that a move to New York didn't make sense. My husband liked L.A., and we had two kids under four. Since I didn't want the job, I had nothing to lose. I doubled down on the joke. "Yes, I'm serious. I mean, you wouldn't wear the so fine jeans every night. The idea is to build up anticipation as you near the end of the monologue so the audience can't wait for you to turn around and head to the desk. Will he be wearing the so fine jeans or not? And when you do, they'll go nuts." Our meeting wrapped up quickly. There was no callback. Jon and I have bumped into each other a few times since. I've never had the nerve to ask if he remembered my ludicrous pitch. My guess is he erased it from his memory, which means the So Fine Jeans idea is still up for grabs. James Corden, call me. Marshall Brickman. On May 25th, 1997, I emailed a friend gushing like a teenager. "I spent 2 hours on the phone with Marshall Brickman this morning. There's a chance we'll work together on a TV show." I have a huge comedy crush on Marshall, who was the co-screenwriter of Woody Allen's funniest movies. Here's mathematical proof. Woody Allen plus Marshall Brickman equals Annie Hall, Sleeper, Manhattan. Woody Allen minus Marshall Brickman equals Scoop, Folly's Friends, whatever works. Okay, I made up Folly's Friends, but if you didn't immediately realize that, I've made my point. Marshall worked in TV early in his career, writing for Candid Camera and The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. 30 years later, he was looking to make a return. He'd written a hilarious pilot script, Norman of the Future, about, wait for it, a guy named Norman who lived in the future. NBC bought the project, and Marshall was interviewing TV writers with recent sitcom experience to executive produce the series with him. I had just left Sabrina and loved his idea with all my heart. We spoke over the phone about how the future and magic overlap. I quoted Arthur C. Clarke's third law. Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. He thought I'd be a fine addition to the creative team and told the network. NBC refused to approve me. They wouldn't even meet with me to discuss the project. I was devastated. I felt like I'd proven myself as a showrunner. Did Sabrina not count because it was a TGIF show? Did my gender factor into the equation? Marshall was a complete class act and went to bat for me. The network refused to budge. In this case, my disappointment goes beyond the personal. Marshall's unique brand of smart, silly comedy never made it to air. Norman of the Future had no future. Seinfeld. Seinfeld was wrapping up their second season when my agent, Abby Adams, submitted me to be a low-level writer. The show wasn't a hit yet, but I'd been a fan back when it was called The Seinfeld Chronicles. The first step to meeting with co-creators Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David was to get the approval of Castle Rock executive Glenn Padnick. Abby sent my scripts over, and Glenn responded with this letter. Dear Abby, thank you for letting me read the enclosed Newhart, Gary Shandling, and Simpson scripts by Nell Scovell. As I said on the phone the other day, I really enjoyed them. Yesterday, I gave copies of the Simpson script to Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David with my recommendation that they consider her for next season. As you know, the bigger issue is whether we have a next season. If we do, I hope Miss Scovell will be available to work with us. Very truly yours, Glenn Padnick. Here's the key sentence. As you know, the bigger issue is whether we have a next season. Seinfeld was on the bubble. It scraped by for 2 more seasons before breaking into the Nielsen Top 30. A meeting never happened, but I held on to the Castle Rock letter because it offered encouragement early in my career. Now it hangs in my office as a reminder of how the greatest success story in the history of television came close to getting canceled. I did eventually get a chance to work with Larry David. In 2007, Curb Your Enthusiasm threw out a net, soliciting ideas for the upcoming season. I typed up a few notions, including one where Larry needs to bring flowers for a hostess gift and decides to steal them from a roadside memorial. Larry bought the concept and turned it into Season 6's The Ida Funkhauser Roadside Memorial. The show didn't give me on-screen credit, but they paid me $2,000. Larry also gave me his word that the show would pay writers better in the coming season. With that incentive, I pitched some additional story ideas. Larry seemed interested in one concept, but it didn't move forward. A year or so later, we both attended a book party. Our mutual friend Kimberly Brooks introduced us. Larry, do you know Nell?
Nell! Of course I know Nell, Larry said. In fact, I was just talking about you today.
Whoa. Larry David was talking about me? That felt good.
Really? How come? I asked. Well, one of the producers said that you'd sold us 2 ideas for episodes, but I insisted it was just one. We argued about it, and now here you are. You can solve the mystery.
Oh, I said, a little disappointed.
It was just one.
Yes, said Larry, happy to have been right.
But you did like another idea of mine, I added quickly, trying to save face.
Which one?
The one about the pee drinker.
Larry looked confused.
I repitched the idea.
Larry's at a party with a guy who won't stop talking about all his thrilling adventures. The guy goes hiking in the Himalayas, helicopter snowboarding, sailing around Tierra del Fuego, and in every story,
He runs into complications and recounts how, in order to survive, he was forced to drink his own pee. Later, Larry sees the thrill seeker go into the bathroom with a near-empty bottle of beer, and when he comes out, the bottle is filled to the brim. Larry watches as the guy takes swigs from the beer bottle and becomes convinced that the guy is drinking his own urine. The great adventures are just a cover. The truth is, the guy is purposely putting himself into life-or-death situations because it's the only socially acceptable way to drink your own pee. I didn't say, ta-da, at the end of the pitch, but it was implied. I looked at Larry expectantly. He shook his head and offered one long, drawn-out syllable. No. Cue the Curb Your Enthusiasm theme, mandolin and tuba. Chapter 13. You Sexy Mother Writer. I believe the children are our future. Meals. Shorter, Jonathan Swift. At the exact age of 29, I opened the New York Times book review and thought, how nice! Kurt Vonnegut, one of my favorite novelists, wrote an essay. One paragraph later, I felt sucker-punched. Here's what Vonnegut wrote. If Lloyd's of London offered policies promising to compensate comical writers for losses of senses of humor, its actuaries could count in such a loss, occurring on average at 63 for men and for women at 29, say. Say what? My comedy career was just taking off, and now someone I respected was predicting that I'd lose my sense of humor, the source of my livelihood, at any moment. And why did men get 34 more years of being funny than me? While the ages seemed off, Vonnegut did identify a truth. In comedy, growing old is an occupational hazard. In 2010, TV and screenwriters were awarded $70 million to resolve a class action suit that charged networks, studios, and talent agencies with age discrimination. The cutoff age for participating in the suit was not 60 or 50. It was 40. 40 is when doctors, lawyers, and accountants start hitting their stride. Sadly, writers line up more with strippers,